This is talking with Von Eshelman at Ersey in Helsinki on 4 August 78. Well, could you, first of all, just tell me what your educational background was and how you first came in contact with radar or radio astronomy?
Well, after high school, I started as a mechanical engineer in the General Motors Institute of Technology, but this was 1942, and the war years, of course, had started. And knowing that I would soon be drafted, I joined the Navy voluntarily and was trained as a... Oh, I took an examination and showed some aptitude in mathematics, so they put me into their program for radar technician.
Mm-hmm.
And I went through the Navy schools in Chicago and Washington, D.C., and then stayed on there for a while as an instructor in a Naval Research Laboratory.
Oh, yes.
Out there at in sonar and radar, both actually. Radar was quite secret at the time. I then was thinking of going to the Naval Academy, but changed my mind and went to sea instead, and was a radar technician on board a light cruiser, USS Providence.
Is this now after the war?
No, this is still during the war.
Still during the war. Yeah.
And but by the time I got to the European theater, the war was over. I was on a flagship and visiting ports in the Mediterranean. I don't exactly know what I heard at the time, but somehow the word came through that the Signal Corps was doing something with regard to lunar radar mm-hmm. echoes.
Right.
We had an SP radar on board the USS Providence. A colleague and myself, on a full moon night, on several occasions, attempted to get radar echoes from the moon using this 1 megawatt peak radar. By, of course, you don't use the standard mode of operation, but we just keyed it on, which meant at its maximum duty cycle, which would be the pulses separated by mostly space in between, for a second, and then turned it off and waited to see if we could get anything, any indication on this CR.
2.5 seconds later.
Yeah.
Right. Any luck?
No, we didn't see anything.
Now that should be enough power, should it not?
Well, these are extremely short pulses, and the average power was quite low, and those pulses would be spread out considerably, so average power is a more important mm-hmm. parameter in those regards. And we did not see any.
That's interesting. This was 1945 or
that would have been 45, 46.
Mm-hmm.
42, 43, 46. Probably 45.
When did you first hear about the meteor radar effect?
Well, then I, after the Navy, I took a bachelor's degree at George Washington University, and then went to Stanford University and worked on toward a PhD, and happened to be thrown into a group working in radio and radio propagation. And in particular, they had a research project on meteors. It had started just a few years before then.
Okay, now what period are we talking about now?
First went to Stanford in 49.
So this is a few years after that, and who was this? Who were in this group?
Well, Mike Villard, Larry Manning, Alan Peterson. Alan Peterson was a student with me, and we both finished about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
1952, we received PhDs. I did my dissertation primarily on the mathematical theory of radio reflection from meteor trails, including mm-hmm. the possible use in communications where you have oblique paths, that is a transmitter at one place, a receiver several thousand kilometers away, and you can send the communication via the meteor mm-hmm. reflections from the meteor trails.
So your interest really was not primarily astronomical?
Not to begin with.
A bit more practical interest.
In that case, it was being supported by the military, and it had an aspect of secure communications,
mm-hmm.
since the meteor reflection that once set up between point A and point B is probably not usable from A to C or B to
right,
C.
Right.
And there's a statistical probability that it could be, but in general it isn't.
Now, what other groups were there in the world that were working on meteor radar at that time? The Jodrell Bank, of course.
Jodrell Bank under Lovell. There's a group in Canada with Peter Millman and...
McKinley?
Don McKinley. Some in Australia and some in New Zealand. Some of the same people are still involved, I believe.
Yeah.
Elliot is here, I believe.
Yeah, right, but was he doing active radar? I
think so.
He was mainly interested in the theory of.
I didn't work. I never visited them at that time, and asking me some questions. I'm sure I could come up with the answers if I thought a while, but it's...
Well, like I say, it's a secondary interest to me, but I was...
But in terms of the group I was in, I think I got more interested in the astronomical aspects of meteors than some of the other people, and tried to work on the radiance and what that meant in terms of distribution in space of the particles, and pointed out the in terms of the velocity distribution, what that meant in terms of their orbit characteristics, being primarily direct. And
did you have any views at that time on the controversy that Oerpic and Lovell were involved in as to whether there are any extrasolar system orbits?
Yeah. And of course, we measured velocities based on the diffraction at the head echo, and the fact that you have thousands of echoes between the limits set by the escape velocity of the Earth and 72 kilometers, which is the RMS of the escape velocity of the Sun at 1 AU, and the escape velocity of the Earth meant pretty strongly to us that they were not. Even if you did get one, of course, that could have been perturbed somewhere. And,
so
you might eventually expect to get one.
So amongst the radar meteor people, it was pretty good agreement.
Yeah, no, they were all would say that they're I built an array at Stanford at about that time to push the detectability as far as possible to track down to 15th magnitude meteors because of the thought that they might conceivably be different in terms of the rate or origin type of thing. And I built a, maybe you have...
Is this the one that's 48 Yagis?
Yes, yeah.
13 meter wavelength. Right. So you published about it in 57 here. So this was after your
after
PhD.
After PhD, right. PhD is 52.
You stayed on.
Right.
And what did this array turn up?
Well, primarily that the mass density continues on down another five orders of magnitude from what was generally known before then. It was difficult to get velocities on the very smallest ones, but the ones that we could get on were still in the same, they were not distinctly different, in other words. There was some effort toward this primarily because people working in the communications field found, this is about the same time as extended propagation was coming in, where you found you could get signals over the horizon continuously by scattering in the ionosphere, lower ionosphere, E region. And some of us thought maybe, conceivably, that meteors themselves could account for all of it.
I see.
You get so many overlapping in time that you get a continuous signal. And other people said it was irregularities due to turbulent phenomena and so forth. One of the critical tests, in fact, was that if you propagate from A to B, looking on a plan view, if it were due to irregularities, then you'd want to minimize the sum of the two path lengths, so you would point the antennas toward each other to intersect in a side view over the midpoint.
Yes.
But if they were meteors, since reflection from meteors is aspect sensitive, there are no horizontal meteors because the rain doesn't fall horizontally. And
even though
the wind blows pretty strongly, if it's falling, it has to fall at a little bit of an angle. So if you do the statistics on this and also the effect of the duration of the echo, which weights everything toward the center, you find instead that you should look at regions off to the side of the path.
I see.
And in fact, the people working in that ran tests to find that they got more. Not strongly more, but they got more if they, as opposed to the central path, if they pointed to this side in the morning and this side in the evening, and maybe this kind of side in the afternoon, well, whatever, I'd have to think which way it is, but mainly it's the basic thing that the Earth in sweeping
towards
through space has the meteors coming
towards
in toward
the
morning
edge.
Side, mostly the apex of the Earth's way.
I see.
Now that was continuous propagation. The question of meteor burst communication was going on at that time also, and Peter Forsyth in Canada, they had what they called the
Project something, I think I've heard about it.
Yeah,
some woman's name, I think.
Yeah, I can't think of her name. Janet, that's it.
Yeah. Something like that, yeah.
J-A-N-E-T, or Janus, maybe it was. No, it must have been Janet. It's related to Janus, the god that looks forwards and back.
Type I see.
But in any event, the concept there was that you'd have fairly low power systems, maybe pointing at this intersection where you're more likely to get echoes and uttered. You wait for the meteor to occur that does get a reflection over that path. You know that exists because you have a transponder at the other end that sends back along the same path. You then dump information at a high rate. As soon as you're informed by the round trip path that the echo is beginning to get weak, you stop and wait for the next one to come up.
I see.
So that had aspects of low power, inexpensive type of thing, long distance, at a frequency that you normally couldn't use for ionospheric propagation, plus a possible classified aspect of